From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Craig Needles Podcast and the Friday Roundtable here at ClassicRock981.com, LondonNewsToday.ca. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, the Craig Needles Podcast is brought to you by our friends over at the Covent Garden Market and at downtown London. I am joined here in the studio by Jennifer Dunn, the Executive Director of London Abuse Women's Center, Jesse Roger, the Executive Director of ANOVA, and political insider Ryan Goss. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
I would like to congratulate Jen on, from what I understand, I was not there. I was the only person in this room who was not there. But
yeah, Craig, you weren't there.
I was busy today, and we'll explain that in a second. We got Covent Garden Market launching on Classic Rock 98.1 today, so I was down there this morning. But another tremendously successful International Women's Day breakfast, so congratulations to you and the team at LOC for making that happen, Jen.
Thank you so much, and thank you to everybody else in the room that was there. I'm just kidding. I'm going to bug you about that.
That's fair. I deserve it.
It was really great. We had all levels of government there. You know, it's just really, really good to see everybody come together. So, yeah, it was great.
And I only missed out on the Taylor Swift tickets by $6,000. But hey.
Yeah, they went for more than $7,000, eh?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
7,100, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
So exciting.
I'm glad that it was such a great fundraiser for the London Abuse Women's Center, as it always is.
Thank you.
And happy International Women's Day to everybody and certainly everybody listening as well. So very, very nice day and glad that it was so successful this morning. Let's talk about some things that are going on here in the City of London. And there's a couple of big ones. For starters, a comment and some thoughts from city staffers that some people were not necessarily thrilled to hear. And now they've kind of taken on a life of their own because, well, the leader of the opposition federally has weighed in on this ordeal as well. Kevin Dickens, who's the deputy city manager of social health and development, essentially said something like, you know, the numbers are the numbers and outlined this in the report. But the line that people latched onto was, encampments being part of the fabric of London. The fabric of London just shows that this is really kind of entrenched here. That, in my belief, is a very bad thing, but the alternatives are simply non-existent right now. Jesse, are encampments part of the fabric of London in your estimation, and what was your reaction to that comment?
So encampments have been happening and have been present in our community for a very, very, very long time, and so this is not... I think for some who are part of the conversation right now, I'm grateful that so many people are part of the conversation, but this is not a new thing. This is something that's been happening for a while. Doesn't mean it's an okay thing. Doesn't mean that's something that we want to see continue. But as a community, we've only really been talking around the table with sort of a lot of people around the table about how we stop having people needing to sleep rough for a very short amount of time compared to the magnitude of the situation. So I think it's important for us to be honest about what's going on. I think it's also important to be honest about what happens in the colder months is that homelessness just gets hidden, right? And when I think about the women that we serve at ANOVA and LOC, like they couch surf, they have to do survival sex work. We just don't see it. So when it gets a little warmer, you're going to see more people sleeping rough outside. So I think it's better that we're honest with ourselves, because then maybe we can actually do something about it.
Yeah. The first step of identifying the problem is acknowledging that there is an actual real life problem. Fabric of London, Jen, what were your thoughts?
I don't know if I have anything additional to add other than what Jesse said, to be honest with you, because I think, you know, everything that Jesse said is absolutely true. The word fabric is, you know, maybe that's not the correct word to use, but I think it shows the prevalence of what's going on. And I think maybe we should shift the conversation from that and those who are, you know, living rough and, you know, talk about why that's happening and maybe shift the conversation to something like guaranteed livable income or increasing ODSPOW rates or, you know, mental health support.
Doesn't that sound logical?
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know why we can't talk that way or be like, yeah, this is a huge problem. It continues to be. People don't deserve to, you know, be living like this. What can we do? You know?
Yeah. And that's part of the issue, Ryan. And I'll mention this to you because Pierre Polyev saw this story on CTV or someone on his team or whatever and tweeted out, what was it? You know, something like 8 years of Trudeau and this is what's happening. I don't know if we can necessarily pin all of this on the federal government or even, but at the same time, if you want to talk about this being an issue in London, I think that's fair. Let's bring up some constructive solutions here, and I'm not seeing that.
Well, 100%. And you know what? That's politics, and you know I'm not going to sit here and really waste too much time on Pierre Poilievre. One thing I will say, though, is that this is a problem that is not London-specific. This is from coast to coast to coast, and we're having this problem. I do believe the language that was chosen, in my humble opinion, was defeatist, to be quite honest with you. I think that I would... And you know what? Knowing Kevin as well as I do, I think if he could walk it back and maybe choose words differently, he probably would.
Yes. And I very much like Kevin. I think that Kevin's got the best interest of the city at the forefront of his mind. I really believe
100%. He does very hard work, and it's a very difficult job. Like many people in this room, they do very difficult work that I honestly can't fathom doing every single day. So I will.
You talking about me?
You and I probably have it easier. I will preface it. I will preface my comments with those, but I will also say this. I will say that I am personally not a fan of encampments. I don't think that we should accept them. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that we have to constantly remember that there are people's brothers, sisters, mothers, daughters, children in those encampments, and we have to put a face and a name to them. And I think that we have to do everything we can to try to find a solution on how we get them across the street. Get them off the street.
Yep.
My boss and I, MP Fragascatos, we were out west a couple weeks ago. We were in Regina, Saskatoon, Lethbridge, and Calgary. And when we were in Regina, we met with an Indigenous organization that was doing incredible work. They had just set up a transitional housing that was modular. And we said, tell us a bit about encampments here, because they've had significant problems. And the word, it really pierced through to me, because they looked at us and they said, there's nothing good that happens in encampments. And we believe they should be taken down as quickly as they are put up. Mm-hmm. That being said, in order to do that, you need to have somewhere for those people to go. Right. I want to be very clear.
Yeah.
So we aren't there yet, but they're doing some pretty great things in Regina. They are finding a solution, a combination between shelters, between transitional housing, working with other social organizations as well. So I think to just say that is the fabric, and that we're going to accept this, and we're just going to say it's okay, I don't agree with that, but I'm also not naive enough to think this is a super complicated problem that I don't have all the answers to, but I will never accept someone sleeping in a tent as their primary place of residence. I just can't. I can't sleep at night thinking that that's just going to be okay, and we're going to say that that's the fabric of our city.
Yeah, and for me, the issue is what goes on in encampments is, in a lot of cases, dangerous, especially for women and girls, and I don't have to tell Jesse or Jen about that. They know that. And I have got a lot of concerns about that. But what you said, Ryan, is bang on, which is I'm all about no more encampments. I think that sounds great. Right now, we don't have alternatives to that. We don't have, well, just go here, or just here's a warm bed for you to sleep in tonight. That isn't what we have. So therefore, encampments is what happens. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, like we're full at Anova. Yeah. It takes about four times for a woman to actually get a space, and we're turning away women at the rate of 95%. So when we say, to your point, Ryan, we need to have a place for them to go, I think that's the issue number one. Otherwise,
well, and you can't just like put a roof over someone's head and everything's okay.
No,
you need right? So there's like other pieces to that too. Right?
Yeah. For people to be successful, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. You have a responsibility.
Yeah.
You're bang on. And you've heard me say on this podcast before, Craig, that, you know, I go to Indwell a lot for the work that they do and the wraparound supports that they provide. They not only provide the shelter, the home, but they also provide the wraparound support services to make sure that those people are successful. Mm-hmm. You know, many people come into our office and say, well, just take a vacant building here, let's convert it, and just let's take people off the street and put them there. You can't do that and be successful. You just can't. It's much more complex than that. People are coming off the street with mental health issues. They're coming off the street with a long list of different, different complex trauma. The list can go on and on as to what they're dealing with. And we need people there that work in this space, that know what's going on, to be able to provide them with the wraparound services that they need. So it's not a simple fix, but I go back to what you had actually just said when you brought up Pierre Poilievre's comments, is that you do have to come with solutions. It's what we just
come
need
to the table with something.
Exactly. We need to stop pointing fingers. Yeah. We need to be able to say, this is a problem. It's terrible that it's gotten worse. Here's maybe something we should try.
Right.
Just come up with it. Be part of the conversation instead of just the finger pointing. And I will give a bit of credit to the City of London. in that they brought everyone to the table, at least to start to have those conversations with this hub model. And, you know, it's not perfect, no, but at least they're bringing everyone together to sit down and have conversations and, you know, disagree in a respectful fashion, but come to a consensus to move our community forward. Not many communities across the country are doing that.
Could you imagine if Pierre was like, what if I start guaranteed livable income?
That would be a real life solution.
Could you imagine if he was like in that tweet, he was like, yeah, how about this?
Here's my idea for this.
Yeah.
Well, and the day that happens from Pierre Polyev, I will ride a unicorn. But, you know, it is. But that would be amazing. No question.
Because here's the thing. I'm all for criticizing something and saying, hey, this is a problem and here's what's going on. But to me, that criticism has to come with here's either what we can do better or a step towards what is better. And Jesse mentioned it. If we want to be serious about what's going on there, A, we've got to build accessible housing. And B, we've got to increase Ontario Works and ODSP rates. Because the rates right now are not livable. And Sarah May Chitty, a friend of mine, tweeted, and she blacked out the personal information, but she found someone's ODSP receipt paperwork on the street the other day, and the housing allowance for the month, I think, was, or maybe a two-week period, either way, it's not no good. It was less than $400. I don't know if you've looked at the London rental market lately, but that is not getting it done for half a month.
No.
It's not. So we can't sit here and wonder why there are people who cannot afford rent or whatever it is, because it's very clear that what they have been provided, if they're on Ontario Disability Support Program, is not even close to enough to actually go and pay the rent someplace.
Yeah.
So this is the problem we wind up in. It's a multi-government level problem, mm-hmm. and the impacts are on London streets. And, you know, for me who lives downtown, works downtown, walks around a lot downtown, I see it a lot. I see it every day. And when I walk through Ivy Park or I walk through Harris Park or whatnot, and I see the tents and whatnot set up by the Thames River, I say to myself, we have failed the people who are in those tents.
Mm-hmm. It's not just on this. It's not just on the streets. It's in schools.
Yeah, that's
right. Because I think part of we talk about these interventions of how we need to house people. We also need to have a conversation about prevention, right? Like activities and like supports for kiddos to be able to get them connected, to be able to get them, you know, reading, to make them feel like they're part of a community. Like those kinds of things are prevention for things like homelessness, things like gender-based violence and violence against women. Like I think we forget in this conversation about the investments that need to be made around prevention. We're so consumed with this challenge about the interventions that we need. I just sometimes worry that we forget about the prevention. And I don't even, like what, like a, what is this saying about like a the pinch or a penny or whatever?
The ounce of prevention, like, you know, is worth a pound of cure. I say that a lot.
There you go. So I think that's also needs to be part of this conversation that I haven't heard a ton of, and that's missing for me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. And, you know, I'll mention it again, but when we talk about the prevention aspects of it, if we keep people out of poverty, maybe they're not showing up at Locke or Innova. Maybe they're not showing up in the ER. Maybe they're not showing up in the criminal justice system. Maybe they're not showing up at the food bank. There are places where society would be better off if these people were not in poverty, but we essentially keep them in poverty with the way that things are currently set up, and this is bad. Let's talk about the encampment issue as a whole from the perspective of what can be done short term here, do we think? Are we doing the right things right now when it comes to getting people out of encampments, do you think, Jesse? Or are there things that we need to be doing in your estimation?
I think some of the interventions that we've been doing, especially since the start of the hubs, have been really reassuring, right? Like going in, making sure people are okay, making sure we're talking about things like fire safety. We hear about like some of these tragic deaths that are happening in encampments, and the reality is that there are some people who it's not like, oh well, just come into the homeless shelter, come to Innova. Some of them don't want to do that. They've had terrible experiences with systems, and so how do you meet people where they're at? Jen has said this to me I think two or three times this week. Like meeting people where that is really important, and I think that is encouraging. I think harm reduction is really an important piece to this, because it is, we're like, this is a marathon, not a sprint. Mm-hmm. That's the cliche I say to my team all the time.
Yeah, it's a marathon. I just real quick aside, and I didn't put this on our sheet, but did want to know if any of you have comments in regards to the City of London extending funding for Safe Space. Not as long as they had originally wanted, but there is some extended funding for Safe Space in there. What do you think of that conversation and where they wound up
Fantastic.
On that? You're happy with where they
yes.
were? Okay.
Yes, yeah, same.
Yeah.
It should be longer.
Yeah.
Should
yeah.
be more.
Yeah.
You know.
Because that was, the original ask was, hey, get us to June. And I think they got them to, was it the end of April or something along those lines?
May?
Yeah.
Something?
Yeah. But either
did
way.
Did you see some of the numbers that came out of how many individuals were served by these organizations?
I did.
Over the last however many months or whatever. Yeah. I don't know them right off the top of my head. But I'm like, that's a lot of work that's being done. It just is. And we need to, Jesse just said it, we need to continue to meet people where they're at. And that's what people need right now.
Yeah, I have a bit of a problem with the funding. Not that the organization is receiving the funding, but how funding is being doled out by the City of London, I do have a problem with. I find that it's very much a patchwork quilt.
Right.
And I find
in the budget, let's not.
Precisely. Yeah, and I find that we're getting it onto the floor. Yeah. We're having these conversations all willy-nilly. We're not doing a solid job at looking long-term and making sure that we have a roadmap in place to not only meet people where they are now, but to look into the future and how we help the people that will be in this situation 2, 3, 4 years from now. So I really think that I find every year I get upset around the winter response every year, because I find that there's snow on the ground or it's freezing outside and funding still hasn't been.
Winter's going to happen.
Exactly. Like, yeah. It's not like if. Now, sure, winters are getting warmer unfortunately, with climate change. But at the end of the day, we know that this is going to happen. We know that it's going to get cold. We know people are going to be outside. Why are we having these conversations so late? And that is my frustration. And as someone who kind of knows how the sausage is made, so to speak, within government, that's inexcusable. It can be done. It really has to, a decision has to be made early on. And Craig, you mentioned about the budget. Let's look at it from the 4-year budget. Let's look at, and if we can't do that for whatever reason, let's start planning in May for next year instead of, hey, let's talk about this in September or October. And there's already,
because no one should be shocked when it gets cold.
Exactly.
Well, to be clear, it didn't really get that cold this year, relatively speaking, but it still got cold enough that people should want to sleep inside.
Precisely. Yeah. And I want to be very clear about this. I'm not blaming the current council for this. Like, this is decades back. This has been a problem. And, you know, I'm going to get calls from councillors and municipal employees saying, well, you know what? We only have so many ways to raise revenue. And again, I want to say to them that this is also a multi-level government conversation, right? I understand that a lot of funding comes from the province for this. There's also reaching home dollars that come from the federal government. These are conversations that need to be had. So long-term, we need to look at the funding model about how this looks for, you know, the next generation. But in the short term, we also need to look at not doing such a, frankly, a poor job and a patchwork quilt at funding these organizations, because it's not fair to the clients. It's not fair to the organizations. It's not fair to the community. It's not fair all the way around. And it's just not a way to run a, you know, an over $1 billion corporation either. We need to do a better job at that.
No, I think that's fair to say.
Agreed. Patchwork funding is the bane
system. Well, it makes it hard for someone in your position to plan, doesn't it? Like, oh, I hope
so
we get this
work.
Money.
It's
It'd be
so
cool if
work.
We did, and you have to put a lot of work into making it happen,
it's
right?
It's almost not worth it.
Well, and we hear it federally all the time. Like we, in fact, I may have heard it from both the individuals standing in this room that project-based funding is not the way to go. We need core funding, right?
Yeah.
And we've talked about that. But on this issue, it can't all lie on the federal government. It's frankly, we understand the Constitution and the jurisdiction of powers and in jurisdiction, how the powers are divided up, I should say, and everyone needs to be at the table. And Craig, I want to go back to your original point, is when you talked about Pierre Poilievre's tweet or post or whatever it was. You know what people just don't give a shit about anymore is that they don't care about partisan politics. So I just find that the fact of the matter is that they do not care about finger pointing. They don't care about getting the cheap political points. They just want to get stuff done.
I agree with that. Not everyone, obviously. Some people still like to, you know, the hyper partisans. But I will say this. Do people give a shit about political jurisdiction anymore? Because when we're talking about homelessness, that's not necessarily
that's a fair point.
Yeah.
But the problem is that again, we run into the Constitution, right?
And then
we run into stay, and then we get into it where it's the politicians start to say, stay in your lane, right?
Right.
This is not your lane. And just like when the federal government's going to give money or the province is going to give money, they're going to want some metrics in place to know that their money is being spent responsibly and that there is a quote unquote return on investment, for lack of a better term. So like it or not, we have to care about jurisdiction. But I think what everyone needs to do is drop the partisanship. Everyone needs to talk about solutions and how we and how we do that. Because I'll tell you what, when you talk about universal basic income, UBI, anything of that sort, we're never going to get there, ever. We're never going to have an honest conversation unless everyone can drop those political guards down and do an honest review of what the return on investment would be for the country to do that and how that would look, how we would fund it, what programs we would collapse. But that's never going to happen because everyone's going for the cheap soundbite. And that's what bothers me a lot about the communications coming out of certain political parties. It's all about the soundbite. And I will say that there's an MP that we work with very closely in this area that is from another partisan bend she's absolutely fantastic. And she says to us all the time, all I care about is getting stuff done. And I don't care about the partisan divide. Sure, question period. There's times to do that. There's times for that in politics. But she has been an absolutely fantastic partner for us to work with. A huge shout out to Karen Vecchio. She's fantastic. My boss has an amazing relationship with her. And her and my boss have shown how you can pull that partisanship aside, get stuff done, and still do what you have to do being in party politics as well. So we need more of that. We need to do that in order to have these real difficult conversations about how we change it. Otherwise, Craig, we will all be here in 5 years having the same conversation with no real major change.
I agree. The only thing that I will say is on the jurisdiction piece, I know that it matters. It's relevant to how things are working in this country. I understand that. I just think that a lot of people in Canada, when you say, well, I'm mad at the Trudeau government because hospitals are too crowded, someone's going to say, well, that's not their jurisdiction. And the person might respond, I don't care whose jurisdiction it is. Someone's got to fix it. And I think that maybe there's like a civics lesson in there, of course. However,
yes,
there's a lot of voters who either A, don't know that, or B, don't care about that. And I think that's at least part of the conversation here, is that there are some voters that I just want the problem that I don't like, I want it fixed. I don't care who's responsible. I don't care whether it's a provincial issue, federal issue. I want it fixed. And I think that's framing some of where the electorate's at right now. And I don't know what we do about that, but that's where I'm at. Anything else on city funding, safe space, encampments before we move on to another thing?
No.
Sounds
no,
like we're
I have
good.
I have like one thing.
Yes,
I didn't know we were allowed to swear.
Cheryl Miller.
I was just
broke the dam years ago, so I knew I could. This is the first time I've ever dropped one, and I will say thank you, Cheryl, for allowing that, because I thought the same thing.
Here's the thing: the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council can do nothing about what I say on here because we're on the internet. When we were doing the show at the other place, there was no swearing.
Yeah.
Now, Cheryl still broke that rule, but that's neither here nor there. Let's talk about closed circuit TV in London. And there are more closed circuit TV spots coming in this city. And some people think, well, this is a bad idea. We're going to have some privacy concerns here. Others would say, hey, you know what? This is something we need for investigations and so forth. My belief on these things has always been this. There are places where you have an expectation of privacy. The corner of Dundas and Richmond is not one of those places. Walking around on York Street is not a place where you have, in my estimation, an expectation of privacy. Now, does that mean that we should have these cameras everywhere? I don't know. That reasonable people can disagree. I just don't know if it's a privacy concern. Jen, what do you think of the CCTV conversation this week?
Well, I think, like, I was going to say I'm kind of split on it, but it's maybe more a 60-40 split, not 50-50. I don't know. So I think the privacy piece is a big piece, but I think also about those who are maybe most vulnerable. I'm thinking maybe if a child goes missing and there needs to be some kind of evidence of where that child was last seen and how helpful something like that could be and how it could save someone's life, you know, in that regard. what is the cost? What is the, there's so many questions I have
about it.
Costs
about $200,000 the province chipped in.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Which, well, it's not an insignificant amount of money. $200,000 is a lot of cash.
Yeah, you're right. And so, I mean, there's bigger conversations that could be had about that part too, right? So, yeah, I'm kind of on the fence about the whole thing, but from, I'm going to end up repeating myself here, but from the standpoint of protecting those who are most vulnerable. But again, it's also then a reaction to something and not a prevention, right? Like, it's not going to stop anything from happening. It will help solve
right
a case.
So you have maybe so some more, like, accountability if someone does something.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And then also too, like, it's not, is it going to help someone who is maybe assaulted in an, you know, a different part where there's no camera? Like, you know what right. I mean? So yeah, I'm really on the fence about that.
Jesse?
Yeah, I don't love it. I'm always looking for evidence. I want to know what the evidence is when we're putting in CCTV. And as an organization that has two properties that have cameras everywhere, like, it is, I think I'm a little bit more used to, you know, that whole world. But I get nervous when we talk about putting up more. I want to know why, and I want to know the evidence of if these work or not. I have read some evidence that sometimes having CCTV in some areas makes people feel like that's a more dangerous space, so they stop accessing those public spaces, specifically women. So I think that's worthy of a moment to think about. So I think I will go where the evidence guides me. And so those are my questions of, like, okay. So
yeah, it's a legit question. And I've got a lot of time for, hey, could we have spent this $200,000 or something else? Like, I've got a lot of time for that question here. I just don't know if I'm worried about it from a privacy perspective, just because, again, there's expectations of, like, where I think people expect to have privacy, and I don't think Richmond Row is a spot where that expectation is there, because there's just so many people around, you know what I mean? It's a bit of a different thing than, okay, we're gonna put this, you know, in the stairwell of your apartment building or whatever it is. But that's just my takeaway on it. Ryan, your thoughts?
I'm all for it. Yeah. I think it's a great idea. With that said, I didn't think about what Jesse had just said. I take that, with a lot of weight. And I, as I always say, I follow the evidence too. So if I'm always open to being educated more on the issue, and if I see, if I see studies or documentation that shows otherwise, and I'm always open to reassessing my point of view. But I see it as, everywhere we go, there's cameras. I've just accepted. I was at a bank machine before this podcast, and I looked, and there's a camera right there in the bank machine. True. Everywhere we go, there it's there. And I will say this, is that I agree with what you said, Craig. In certain public spaces, I think we just have to come to the realization that, you know, there isn't that quote unquote privacy there. But I quite like it. I think it acts as a deterrent as well. I know that the small businesses, some other media outlets in town have run stories on this. Talk to small businesses. They love it. They're like, it's a deterrent for for people breaking into their establishment. And I will say,
or even
this,
just the petty vandalism.
Exactly.
And I get that, like, that just, if you run a small business, it'd be annoying to show up in the morning and the window smashed again, right? Like,
100%. And then, I will say this too. If someone says, we have a massive problem with loitering and damage at X corner, right? But if they want to see actual proof of that, then they have this video as well. There's certain things that, when complaints are made, they can be verified and they can be addressed, and they can also see the scale of the problem too, right? Because what is a problem to me may not be a problem for Jesse or Jen, right? So I like it. I also come to the point of, like, if you're doing nothing wrong, like, I for me, that's how I look at it. I don't have an issue, but I understand that there are some complex feelings other ways, and I respect that. But for me, I'm all for it. I like it. I like the fact that we can also know if there's a problem, if there's somewhere to go to see what's happening. That said, I also believe that you should have privacy in certain places, right? I don't necessarily think to the point of, like, apartment hallways or bathrooms or anything like that we should be obviously looking at cameras, right? But the fact of the matter is, keep this in mind too, no matter where you go, there is a camera. People have their phones constantly out, constantly recording. People are on WhatsApp. People are on Snapchat. People are on I sound old. I don't even know all the different
TikTok,
apps.
TikTok.
People on TikTok are on FaceTime. So like, I guess what I hear some people always say, oh, you know, Big Brother and privacy, privacy, privacy. And then you go and you see they have a TikTok account where they put out like 10,000 videos. So for me, I personally don't have any problem with it, but I'm always willing to hear other sides and be educated on it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Last thing I want to ask about was the by-election from this week. And Aaron O'Toole's old riding, and Jamil Giovanni goes in there as the conservative candidate and wins by more than Aaron O'Toole ever won by. And this is a riding where the Liberals had, you know, trotted out the heavy hitters and tried to see what they could do here. Just didn't necessarily work out. Just governing parties do poorly in a by-election, Ryan, or is there more to think about there? Because they traditionally do. Usually who's in government has a hard time in by-elections.
They do. And by-elections, we talked about a couple weeks ago with the by-election for the provincial
the
side.
One,
like by-elections are, they're an interesting beast. They're not your traditional election or the format of it or the feel. That said, I think there's lessons to be taken from that by-election. I think it's kind of in line with where some of the national polling has been. I think that when you're in government, if you're not constantly assessing how you can improve and constantly looking at what you can do to be better and to try to change and pivot and make sure that people feel as though you're still listening, then you're in big, 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 big trouble. So I think the fact is that this is a lesson for the governing party to say, okay, people aren't happy. There's a wide range of reasons why.
Yeah.
There's a long list, right? Whether it's inflation, whether it's interest rates, whether it's, you know, whether it's housing, whether it's crime, whatever, whether it's a whole bunch of issues that don't even pertain to the federal government, but people like to blame Justin Trudeau. The fact of the matter is people are not overly happy right now. So I think that we constantly have to take into account that we need to listen more, we need to talk less, and we need to find about how we can make sure that we stay true to why as a governing party we were elected. And if we aren't doing that, if we're trying to make excuses and roll out the pundits to say, oh, ignore that, don't worry about that, don't do this, I think we're doing a disservice to ourselves. And I think that it's a big, big mistake. So I take it more than with a grain of salt. I would be quite honest with you, but I it's not gospel either for me. But it's definitely a warning bell, warning alarm, repeatedly to say, okay, hey, like, you know, we need to start having more in depth conversations and looking at the core of where people's unhappiness comes from.
Jen or Jesse, anything on the by-election that you think is interesting or on the current status as far as how the Canadians feel about the Trudeau government?
Every time I get asked about a federal election here,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know anything because it changes so quickly, it feels. I think part of it is, just to your point, Ryan, is there's also like, there's some listening that needs to be done, but there's also some communicating that needs to be done, right? And so I think that's the, like for me as a person who's waiting for whenever this writ is going to be dropped. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to be listening to is the communications from the governing party as well as the others about what's happening right now, what the toughest things are for me and my community, and, you know, solutions or strategies that they're going to propose. Because I feel like that's a little bit missing for me. But I don't think I was altogether surprised from what I was reading.
So, Jesse, can I, if it's all right, Craig, can I jump in on the communication part? Because I'll be honest with you, it's like for the last 8 years, it's something that I've said, we are not great at communicating. Mm-hmm. I think we take it for granted that people are just going to assume that they're going to just assume that we're doing the work that they elected us to do. And we just hope that they're, you know, that this is going to reach their kitchen table. And the fact is, I always say, people don't care the vast majority about politics. They care about getting little Billy and little Jane to soccer. They care about how they're going to pay their mortgage. They care about getting to work on time. They care about if they're going to be able to afford their next vacation and if they're going to be able to make, you know, to keep their family going. That's what they care about. So we have to do a better job of reaching into those kitchen tables to tell the message. And that's through different communication tools. And we've always put it off. And as a government, and we do not communicate nearly well enough. And so, but again, we try to really communicate well here locally, but it's like a pebble in the ocean when you think about the country, right? So we mm-hmm. can, of course, talk about what we're doing in our riding, what we're doing in our city, but nationally, we need to do a much better job. And then you know what happens when you don't do that is that the other parties fill that that fill hole. The silence, yeah, they just fill it, yeah. and they spin the message, and then people actually, a lot of people start to believe. Well, there's no different opinion or contradictory statement coming out. Maybe this is true, and I think that we have a real obligation to talk more about what we're doing and why we're doing some things and why we're not doing other things. And I think that that's somewhere where, if like I was looking at my son's report card in the learning skills section, I think that that's where we would get a needs improvement, mm-hmm. Because it hasn't been good enough. Hasn't been good enough in this term, and hasn't been good enough in the two previous terms. I'm not saying we're not doing anything. I'm just saying, mm-hmm. it needs to be much better, much more robust, and much more consistent.
Yeah, I think that's entirely fair to say. And well, we've got whenever this federal election is to sort it all out. Yeah, I'd be utterly shocked.
At least a year out.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, I just think that. Never know. Here's the thing. I understand why that's the belief. I just think that the liberals are not motivated to force their own collapse, and the Democrats are not motivated to go to the polls.
So
long as those two things remain the truth, we're not going to be doing an election until 2025. So there we go. But hey, things change quickly, as we all know. Let's wrap up the Craig Needles podcast there. I want to thank Jesse and Jen and Ryan very much for coming in and doing the podcast with us. Once again, happy International Women's Day to everybody. Once again, congratulations to Jen and the team over at Locke for another excellent breakfast this morning. And I'm glad
thank
that
you.
It went so well.
Thanks.
You will be hearing this podcast perhaps as early as Friday afternoon when I'm broadcasting live from the Covent Garden Market. Just as a heads up, we've figured out that we are going to do the Friday roundtable from there every Friday once all the stuff we ordered for the market comes in, because it turns out you need microphones and stuff. It's part of doing a podcast. So as soon as that comes in, we're going to be doing this podcast from the market every single Friday. And you'll be able to come listen to us live while we do it and sit kind of in that coffee area. There's going to be a speaker out there, the whole thing. It's a pretty grandiose plan we've got. I know. It's going to be a live performance art now. So I'll let you know when all that's going to happen. But excited about the Covent Garden Market partnership. Thanks to them for helping sponsor the Craig Needles podcast, along with our friends over at Downtown London. You can find the Craig Needles podcast at classicrock981.com, londonnewstoday.ca, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.